All right, so this is lesson 21, covering chapter 31 this morning of our study in Proverbs. And this will be the last of the text that we cover, and because our summary will focus on your interaction with the class, what you've thought about it, and some closing thoughts that I have about the chapter. So let's start with the first verse, the words of King Lemuel, the utterance which his mother taught him. So Proverbs 31 is the second and the last appendix to the book. Even that's a little bit of a controversial statement, depending on how you want to define what an appendix is to the book of Proverbs. So if you recall that Solomon wrote the first 9 chapters, and then he wrote, starting in chapter 10, the miscellanies, and they continue. But then at some point, there's a little discussion as to what that point is. At some point, long about chapter 25, Hezekiah's men had assembled the remaining body of the Proverbs together. And so if you're looking for what did Solomon write that he put in a book versus what others added to Solomon's writings later on, the idea of an appendix can get a little tricky. But if you think of people who wrote Proverbs, and at the beginning of this class, it's my opinion that Solomon wrote everything through chapter 29, but he didn't compile them into one book like we have. That's pretty clear. And then chapters 30 and 31 were written by two other authors, Agur, the man who wrote chapter 30, and now we have Lemuel, who is titled in chapter 31. So we know just as little about Lemuel as we know about Agur, which is nothing at all. We have no idea who they are or when they even when they lived. There is some speculation that both Agur and Lemuel are pseudonyms for Solomon himself, and of course that would make Proverbs 31 written by Bathsheba if that were the case. But there's not widespread agreement that that's feasible, but it's a... Because it's a poetic book, there's a lot of dense material being conveyed, and people like to spend a great deal of time trying to parse these words to figure out if there's something there that we should understand. There's not widespread acceptance that Solomon is the author of 30 and 31. There are questions, but it's not settled by any means in terms of being favorably disposed. So what I'm putting forth is that the prevailing opinion is that Solomon wrote through 29, and then Agur wrote chapter 30, and Lemuel is credited with 31. So the there is some question about whether or not all of 31 belongs to Lemuel. The chapter is written really in three sections, verse 1 being the first section, and verse 2 through verse 9 being the second section, and then from 10 through 31. So it's not agreed that the whole chapter belongs to him, although there are, I don't know that people have strong opinions on this. But the Septuagint, for instance, takes an odd position when they transcribed Proverbs. They split chapter 30 after verse 14, where they then insert part of chapter 24, and they split chapter 31 after verse 9, where they insert chapters 25 through 29. So you would find in the Septuagint the first 9 verses, and then you'd go back and find chapters 25 through 29, and then you'd find the end. I'm not sure what problems they thought they were solving by splitting Lemuel's work and Agur's work by putting those extra words in there. I don't know, other than maybe the clear indication in their mind that Lemuel was not the author of 10 through 31. I don't know. But I think, and I'm going to treat chapter 31 as a unified whole. I think there is a thematic element to all of 31, and there's no reason to split it into pieces. So, looking at the very first verse in this first section, the words of King Lemuel, the utterance which his mother taught him. So, it's interesting. We don't even know his mother's name. All we know is that it was Lemuel's mom that told him these things, and then he dutifully transcribed them. So, it was obvious an important point or an important teaching in Lemuel's life that he should be given this information and have it committed to memory so that he could faithfully record it and then argue it again. So it's, I think, important to recognize that these words are the words not of Lemuel, but of his mother to Lemuel. And I think if we start with that picture in mind of who wrote this and who was the intended audience, it maybe Proverbs will take a slightly different, or have a slightly different light shining on it. So, if we start off by thinking, if I were to say, what is Proverbs 31 about? What does it cover? And if your response is anything along the lines of, well, the good wife or the virtuous wife, then I think you're wrong. I think you're wrong in the sense that that's really not what the book is about. Now, the book, that chapter covers a lot of information about this virtuous wife, but the book is written for Lemuel. These are the words his mother gave him. And I think if we start the book thinking along the lines of, what is this mother teaching her son? Then you maybe will find something different in the end result of Proverbs. So I'm not going to press strongly that this is the interpretation. It's a complex chapter, and I think there's room for disagreement as to what the emphasis should be. But I'm going to put forth my case, and hopefully we'll have some time that you guys can give me your ideas about what you think is happening in this chapter. So starting in verse 2, we really have this interesting phrasing of Lemuel's mother. She says, what, my son, and what, son of my womb, and what, son of my vows? So she's has these three questions that are really one question, right, which is really just one word, which is what. It's sort of an odd way to start a conversation, isn't it? And so it's a question, I think, that that reflects a deep longing and a sighing that Lemuel's mother has as she's delivering this teaching to him and emphasizing the importance of what she's trying to say. So the commentator Delitzsch likens this opening to a call, which is like a deep sigh from the heart of a mother concerned for the welfare of her son, who would say to him, this is what is beneficial, and say it in words that strike and remain fixed. So she's opening this passage by saying, I've got something important to tell you. This is a burden on my heart, and this is something that needs to be conveyed to you. And the commentator Zockler describes this opening as an impassioned exclamation expressing the inward motion of the mother's heart at the thought that the son might possibly fall into an evil way. So Proverbs 31 begins then with an impassioned plea on behalf of a mother for the welfare of her son. So Mum Lemuel, I guess that's what we'll call her in this class, describes him as my son, the son of my womb, and the son of my vows, or the son of dedication. So she is impressing upon him the importance of remembering that I am your mother. I am your parent. I have a responsibility to you. I gave you birth. I'm the one that travailed with you, and I'm the one that dedicated you into God's service. I have a profound love for you, and I need to tell you some things to help you walk in the right way. So there's no stated reason in the opening of Proverbs 31 why Lemuel's mom, or Mum Lemuel, is talking this way to her son, right? But there's not much in the way of background given in any of Proverbs. But it could be that she sensed that this was a beginning path for him as he was wandering from perhaps the ways that she had instructed him. Perhaps he was showing a tendency for a love of wine and women, Or perhaps she was simply able to foresee the types of temptation that he would be exposed to, and she wanted to address it in this opening chapter. So that last part is a bit of speculation, but you don't have much of a choice when you're looking for the context of something given in Proverbs, right? I mean, there isn't any. And this is all we have, are these three sentences that are one-word sentences, in a sense. So I'm inclined to think that Mom Lemuel was either foreseeing what was likely to happen or had seen tendencies of what Lemuel might be involved in, and she's giving appropriate warning. That fits very well into the theme we saw through the discourse section of Proverbs, where Solomon was saying, "My son, now when this happens, I want you to respond this way." And I think chapter 31 fits very well as a continuance of that type of instruction. So let's spend some time looking at these verses 3 through 9. "Do not give your strength to women, nor your ways to that which destroys kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law, and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to those who are bitter of heart. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. Open your mouth for the speechless, in the cause of all who are appointed to die. Open your mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor and the needy." And the first instruction we find of Mom Lemuel is for him to restrain his passions, especially as it relates to pursuing women and other physical pleasures, perhaps such as the displays of wealth, maybe food, banqueting, licentiousness. There are ways that we might see that they are destructive in the sense that they are hindering the wealth building of the nation, or as she's describing kings, we're assuming that's who Lemuel is, a prince of some sort in some capacity in some country when we really don't know anything about it. Or maybe that he's pursuing unnecessary military ventures. The chapter doesn't describe for us all the different things that a king might do to destroy a country slowly. So it's pretty limited in its scope, and the chapter is first opening with this idea of giving your strength to women and your ways to that which destroys kings. Now, maybe this is even a slight reference to seeing Solomon's reign being compromised by 1,000 women. Perhaps Lemuel was on the side, or was able to see this, or his mom was able to see this, and she's commenting on it. I mean, there's really no way of knowing for sure, but it's pretty clear that she directs him not to give his strength to women. And in verses 4 through 7, we find that it's not for a king. It's not in a king's place to have strong wine and intoxicating drinks. It's not for them in their capacity as a king to rule as a drunkard. So this is a tricky verse, a tricky set of verses, because some have taken this as a complete prohibition on the consumption of alcohol. And the verse does not prescribe that for us. It actually has a prescription of the right use of alcohol in it, right? I mean, that's one of the things she's saying. Give drink to these people over here. But the instruction seems to be the prohibition against the consumption of alcohol, which clouds your judgment. So the problem that he has, if he becomes someone intoxicated, given over to physical pleasure, because that may be the temptation he's fighting. When he gets to verse 5, what happens is he forgets the law, right? Now, maybe he becomes cruel and oppressing. Maybe he just has cloudy judgment and is unable to render a right opinion in a matter that comes before him. The second half of 5, which is a synonymous line given to reinforce the first one, and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. So it's possible that what she sees is if you have a life consumed with strong drink or being intoxicated, you're going to find that your judgment's cloudy. You're going to allow people to be afflicted, who need someone to stand on their behalf. So I think if we look at Proverbs 31 through this lens of somebody being restrained through the instruction of a parent, somebody being restrained through physical desires, the desire to want a party, the desire to drink a lot, the desire to pursue women, and saying that's not your place, that's inappropriate for you to do that, I think it starts to take shape and make some sense. So, in other words, if kings are given to their carnal appetites, they become poor rulers and they exercise poor judgment. And she's warning him against this sort of behavior. So the commentator Wardlow has this comment about taking too much one way or the other with these verses with the use of alcohol. And he writes that the same providence that furnished the corn or grain, as it was used, furnished the wine. And when the one was used for its own purpose with equal propriety and sinlessness, might the other. So if wine can bring some cheer to those who are bitter of heart, for whatever reason, there could be hundreds of reasons why people are bitter of heart, then so be it. So if you're perishing and your heart is heavy, well then, enjoy a glass. It's not drunkenness that's being advocated, but relief from some particular form of distress. So we find in verses 8 and 9, after this case of how to handle alcohol and what position it should be in, we find that she twice repeats the phrase, open your mouth. So in verse 8, open your mouth for the speechless. And in 9, open your mouth. So again, with the idea of repetition, we need to see that he is being called upon to actively advocate for those who are in need of an advocate. So in the first case, it's for those who are speechless, who are literally dumb, who have no ability to speak the words. And second, we're looking at the poor and the needy. That's the two classes of people that Lemuel is being told to speak for. Now, the first case, it could be that the claimant is physically unable to speak on his own behalf to utter things. But in the second case, it's not that the poor and needy couldn't say something, but that they don't have access to someone who can articulate their need and articulate their plight. So Lemuel is being instructed that he does not have the option of being passive in his oversight in justice, but he must ensure that those individuals who are, I don't like this phrase, but truly disadvantaged, the people who don't have the ability to represent themselves well, that they need someone to stand up for them. For the rich and the powerful are often the ones who want to exploit those who are poor and needy and offer little in the way of resistance. And Mum Lemuel is saying, this is important. As a king, you really need to watch over the people who are especially vulnerable in the hands of those who are better equipped to represent their cases. And I want to stop here for just a minute to bring your mind back to last week's message with Agur, and there are similarities between the two, and why I think the idea of framing Proverbs 31 in a moral sense is a good way to think about Proverbs 31. So both Agur and Mum Lemuel address the need for contentment. Right? So isn't that one of the things that Agur was saying? Feed me with the food allotted to me. He said, don't give me poverty, don't give me riches, teach me contentment in these things so that I can lead a life without sin. I don't want to be drawn into sin because of discontentment. That was the prayer Agur made. And Lemuel's mom is saying something very similar to that, in that it don't give your strength over to women. I don't want you to spend your life thinking about the pursuit of other women. I don't want you to spend your days in drink and in physical pleasure. You need to fulfill your responsibilities and live a contented life. So Agur and Lemuel also ask or are instructed for the care of the poor and needy. So in the last chapter, do you remember the two images that Agur used to describe what the mouth of the oppressor was like? You remember what the two images were? In Proverbs 30, they were the sword and the knives, right? That was the image that out of the mouth of these people, their fangs are like swords and knives. That's how viciously and voraciously, they want to attack the poor and needy, the helpless. They want to go after them. It's as if they have knives in their mouth. So people who are oppressive like that need to be checked by the strong. The strong have an obligation to check those who are rich and powerful, that they don't abuse the privileges that they enjoy. So if there is a background to understanding Hebrew poetry with the idea of the repetition, either the continual building of ideas or the reiteration of ideas as a way of emphasis, because they don't use rhyme like we use rhyme in much of our poetry, then if repetition is the key, we see that this message was given in 30, and we see this message given again, and it's repeated even in 31 within itself in these multi-line instruction. If we don't get the message when it's been repeated on multiple occasions, and in each occasion is repeated internally, then we're really particularly dense people, and we need to step back. This is important that we remember contentment, we remember to curb our physical desires, to keep them in check, and we remember that people need us to speak for them. People need someone to stand up on their behalf, and those who are able to do so have an obligation. In this case, in particular, it was Lemuel that had the responsibility of doing that. So chapters 30 and 31 in these opening sections, I think, have a lot in common with one another about governing your life. And I think if we see these opening verses of 31 as primarily written to the young man, to understand how he should live his life, it frames the rest of the chapter in a slightly different light. So that's my opening apologetic for how to look at chapter 31 a little differently than maybe what is traditionally done. And we'll open it now for some discussion before we get into the rest of the chapter. What comments, questions do you have?
Who do you think Lemuel was?
I
have no idea.
I have no idea at all. No idea. There's a lot of speculation. There's some speculation that he might even be Solomon. But there's nothing decisive about that. And no one has settled, even with the idea of both men, part of the inscription being taken as an appellative rather than a proper name, that there's something about them as a person being conveyed in the significance. But no one's been able to convince the broader body of commentators that that's the case. So these are two men who are largely lost to us, and one woman. Any other comments or questions? All right, now, when I started looking at the Proverbs 31, I wasn't quite sure what to think of it, because you just hear so much about it, right? It's something that we hear all the time. And I came to the conclusion that the best way to describe the approach to Proverbs 31 is it's either deeply inspiring or it's a bludgeon. It seems to be one or the other. So I took an informal poll of people, just asking them, what's Proverbs 31 about? Well, it's about that woman. Right? The woman I could never live up to. But it was interesting that one of the comments given to me was that Proverbs 31 is more than sufficient to bring down the blows from these bludgeons from men and women alike. And I thought that was a little interesting. So I asked, well, how is it that men bring down these? Well, they do it in sort of a tangential way, because they will describe some accomplishment of their wife as being a Proverbs 31 woman. They'll do that in sort of a public sense, which makes all the other women feel deficient because they don't do that particular thing. And they can never hope to achieve this ideal that's set before them. And so I started looking at material, contemporary material for Proverbs 31, and I didn't realize there was such a large market. of material available for people who need Proverbs 31 paraphernalia.
Those are Proverbs 31 bludgeons.
Those are Proverbs 31 bludgeons, that's right, yeah. For sale, that's number 13 in our catalog and number 12 there. That, if anybody's interested, go, there's free shipping to the end of the month. And so, you know, the idea that Proverbs 31 has only one message struck me as, well, that may not be the way to think about Proverbs 31. So let's talk a little bit about the structure of Proverbs 10 through 31, the last 22 verses of the chapter. And the first place, I don't know if you're aware of this, but Proverbs 31, this last section, is an acrostic poem. So each verse, chapter, verse 10 starts with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph, and 31 starts with Tav, the last letter of the Hebrew. So each verse begins with a different letter. So in that sense, it's written like the other acrostics in the Book of Lamentations. Psalm 119 is probably the most famous acrostic. But Proverbs 31 is an acrostic poem that's given. It's a remarkable piece of literature just from its construction in that way. And you have to wonder, why was Proverbs 31 written that way? Why take the trouble to create something in that form of literature? And the answer that comes to my mind is that it was an aid to memory. It was a way to build within the memory A to Z, if you will. The idea of moving from one letter to the next. I can remember, what's the next verse? Oh, it's C, the next one's D, and I can help keep my place to remember it. So this, like the other sections of Proverbs we look at, which were not acrostics, but were written in a way to be memorized. It was given as an aid for God's people to think of it. And in a sense, if that is in fact the case, as an aid to memory, we must say it was a success, right? Because Mom Lemuel gave it to her son, and what did he do? He remembered it. He committed it to memory and then put these words down for us so that we could have it. So I think the idea of memorizing this chapter is important, but it's not clear to me what you're supposed to get from the chapter. So it's obvious that the chapter is written in the sense that there is something valuable about this woman, right? I mean, we're going to spend a little time looking at the value there. But rather than a checklist of all the things that she does, I think we should maybe look at Proverbs 31 through this lens of value and through the husband. So let's start with 10 through 12. Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts in her. She will have so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of his life. And I was reminded of two other passages. Proverbs 18:22, he who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. And Proverbs 12:4, an excellent wife is the crown of her husband, but she who causes shame is like rottenness to the bones. So the first thing we find about this woman that Mom Lemuel is recommending to her son is that she's a virtuous woman, right? She's virtuous. But what does that mean, to be a virtuous woman? Well, let's step back for just a minute. Proverbs 18:22 states that finding a wife is finding a good thing, and in doing so you obtain favor from the Lord. And in that particular verse, the wife is not qualified, right? It's just a wife. It's not a particular kind of wife. She doesn't have any adjectives to describe her. But the condition of finding a wife is what's elaborated on. Finding the wife is a good thing, and what happens when you do so? Well, you obtain favor. You get a rich blessing from God. That's the idea behind it, that God will give you a blessing when you find a wife. So there's no qualifier to the wife. The qualifier is to the benefit that comes in verse 18. But in 31:10, we find that the wife is qualified as the virtuous one. So I think maybe unfortunately the word that when we use virtue today, it tends to be along the lines of somebody with a high moral standard. That would I think express most commonly the way virtue is used. But Our modern usage has deviated a little bit from its earlier uses. The origin of the English word comes from the idea of valor or merit or moral perfection. It stems from the Latin vir, which is man. And so I think that's a little closer to what the Hebrew idea of the word is. The Hebrew word has strength and has power and has might and wealth in mind, as well as does fitness, not an exercise type fitness, but appropriately designed fitness, and in integrity. So the virtuous wife is somebody that's possessing a great deal of strength and is a fit person for the job. But if we head back to Proverbs 12, we find that the qualifier for the wife is that she is excellent. Well, the word excellent is the same word we use for virtuous. It's the same word in both cases. So if you think about the value of the wife, it's the excellent wife who is what? She's a crown to her husband. And she who causes shame is like rottenness to the bones. This wife that's being given to this man is indeed a crown to her. And another wife would be rot to him, right? So this woman is something that glorifies this man. So it struck me that perhaps one of the keys to understanding how we should think through Proverbs 31, the last section, is maybe through the lens of Proverbs 12:4. They're using the same word in mind, they have the same idea, and I wonder if it's possible that Proverbs 10 through 31 is an exposition of, or an application of Proverbs 12:4. It's the excellent wife that you found, and here let's unpack and see how excellent that she is. So this idea of the excellent wife is, I think, important. And marriage is being cast in a different light just through the opening of this section of Proverbs. So in verse 11, we find that the heart of her husband safely trusts her. So we haven't got to all the things and how early she gets up and, you know, how she's not afraid of the snow and she's not afraid of this and she's not afraid of that. And, you know, she's a real estate tycoon and she has all these businesses and, you know, all the things that sort of build up into this, what this woman is actually like. I think these opening verses give us some real insight. The first is that her husband, the heart of her husband, safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. And this might be a bit of an aside, but it seems like the tone of the end of 31 here is being set as an image being presented to us that describes that the husband and the wife are friends. And you've got to get along really well with someone to safely trust in them. That you can trust that the intentions they have are good toward you. And that you know that I don't have to worry about what her motives are or what his motives are, because I can safely trust her. Why? Well, because we're friends. We've got this committed relationship being put together. So I would think they would have to be, at a minimum, they'd have to be good friends in order to have a relationship where the husband knows that she's going to do him good. So it's, if she was working toward him for good and not evil, if that's the way she approaches this marriage relationship, just imagine how peaceful the home is. Right? I mean, these are people who get along well together. These are people who enjoy being around each other because they're not spending their time with their minds clouded with suspicions. So it's perhaps easier to be inclined to think that this woman and this man are part of a wealthier household. That, you know, there is this lesson about have no lack of gain in her industry. I'm sure I'm speculating here, but what if you have a husband that doesn't earn very much? What if your husband is not in the realm of the king, who might have access to considerably more wealth than somebody who shoes horses or something, whatever the lower scale, or somebody who's a day laborer? How much more important would the relationship need to be if you were on the low end of the wage and income spectrum in Solomon's day or in Lemuel's day, that the ability to trust your wife, that what little you're capable of providing that she's going to work well with it. And that you don't have to worry that, not your vast riches, but what little meager things you have, that your wife is going to help take care of those things with you. And it seems to me that if you were a poor woman in ancient days, the attraction of being married to someone who had the capacity of having his heart deeply united to you in friendship would be a really a powerful attraction, right? That would be the sort of marriage I think just about anybody would want. If you didn't think you had a way to earn out of poverty, to earn out of your lower income, to enjoy more comforts, then you would certainly want to have a home that was sort of guided and sort of steered by strength and being excellent, being friends with one another and having a deep relationship. So I don't know. I don't know exactly, well, I have no idea what the circumstances were of Lemuel, but I think if we think back and just use a little imagination to imagine what Lemuel would have had at his disposal, right? In order for his mom to be thinking along something different, that it really wasn't a difficult ordeal for someone in a position of wealth and authority to acquire women, right? That's just not the problem. Solomon did it perhaps more than anyone. I don't know how many other men have rivaled Solomon with having a thousand wives and concubines, right? So the idea that Lemuel could find the one person to have a relationship with and not be like all the other kings, how easy it is for kings to fill their seraglios. Not their harems, but the seraglios, which I just learned was the word to describe the housing of the wives and the concubines. How easy it would have been for him to fill these homes with lots of women, right? There's, in the ancient world, that just wasn't a problem. So if the picture given by Mum Lemuel is that of a home filled with domestic bliss, with people who are working together, irrespective of the amount of income they have, that there's safety, there's trust, and there's love, would be a very different picture in certainly the ancient world of people who could acquire many wives for themselves. So I find that these opening verses, if we look at Proverbs 10 through 31 as an exposition of 12:4, and if we look at the opening of it as a guiding eye to the friendship being built, then I think it helps put the rest of Proverbs 31 in place. Now, I've already been dealing in speculation. I don't have much of a choice, but I think that's the thematic element of chapter 31. But I think there's another element that has bothered me for a while. And when I started this study, I didn't like the idea that Proverbs 31 was written for women. And it struck me as I went through the discourse section that maybe we've got it backwards. Maybe Proverbs 31 is really a chapter written for men. It's really written for the man. And in fact, perhaps the man himself is the center of the last section of Proverbs 31. Right? So that's an interesting idea. So I began looking at it, and I don't know if this is true or not. You guys are free to make your own opinions. But verse 23, long about the middle, her husband is known in the gates where he sits among the elders of the land. One of the things that we learned in the first nine chapters of Solomon is, or the first nine chapters of Proverbs, is how serious Solomon is in educating and training who? His son. Right? It's my son. They're the my son discourses. They're not the my daughter discourses. They're the my sons. There are a few times when he says, oh, my children, but he doesn't say daughters. He says my son, or he refers to him on a few occasions as daughters. Now, we've already discussed the applicability of Proverbs for men and women. We're not going to revisit that. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go listen to the earlier lessons. But what if the trajectory of Proverbs as a whole is a trajectory of the importance of raising your son the right way? What if the trajectory is seeing your son come to fruition as being a godly man? And if that is the trajectory of Proverbs, then when we find it, we get to the middle of Proverbs 31, we find sort of the apex of this acrostic poem being, the husband is known in the gates, where he sits among the elders of the land. Maybe this guy arrived. That he didn't turn out to be the fool, the guy whose head was dense, remember? That was one of the descriptions. The head was literally so dense, nothing could get through. And in fact, we didn't spend much time with this proverb, but you could beat him with a mortar and pestle, and it won't make any difference. You're not going to get anything in. That's the problem. Well, what if this boy turned out? And now he's an elder in the land, a God-fearing elder in the land, who is on his own course of raising children. Perhaps, I don't know. So, if we take this as a possible idea, there are folks, there are lots of chiasms in the book of Proverbs. There are chiasms where chiasms don't exist. And there are chiasms I'm sure people haven't figured out. This is a pretty subjective way of organizing scriptures, but I thought this guy, I don't remember what his name is, Dwayne Garrett, put together a chiastic interpretation of these sections in Proverbs, this last acrostic poem. So, I don't want to go through each of the details, but the important part about the chiasm, remember, is that it graduates to a point, right? And it's the point you're supposed to focus on, and then everything else is a literary device to support that main point, and is usually found in a matched pair of some sort. So, the wife is a virtuous woman, and how is she likened monetarily? Her price is above rubies. And when you get down at the end, I think I have a typo there. It's at the end, it's her husband that's praising just how valuable his wife has been. The husband is benefited by his wife. The husband and children praise the wife. The wife is working hard in the opening, and down at the bottom, she gives to the poor. She has no fear of snow, no fear of the future. Children are clothed in scarlet. She's clothed in dignity. She sells these garments. She's making things. But in the end, it's centered around this idea of perhaps the husband is the one who's seated at the gate, and he is now a man of true wealth. How? Well, because he's found this excellent wife. She's a crown to him. This is what she's done for him, is that she's put him in a place that he can fulfill his calling, right? That's the goal here, is that the husband's fulfilled this calling, and what did he find? He found an appropriate helpmeet to come alongside and do what? And to help him accomplish that goal that he has. And the goal that Solomon had was for his son to be a godly young man who could in turn relate to his children by training them the way they should go. Now, I just have one more slide. I want to close with this, then we'll have a time for discussing. So I argued at the beginning that the great hinge of Proverbs was this concept of the fear of Yahweh. And if you don't get that, if you don't see that as the great theme, the great hinge, you've missed the boat. And the great metaphor of the book of Proverbs were the ways and the paths, right? So in Proverbs 1:7, it's the fear of Yahweh is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. And at the end of the chapter, you've got this son who I think is grown up and matured, and now he has a family of his own. And who did he find? Well, charm is deceitful and beauty is passing. That's Lemuel's mom speaking to him about how to find a wife. But a woman who fears the Lord, who fears Yahweh, she shall be praised. So I find you've got these bookends on either side of the book of Proverbs trying to help us see that it's the way and the path that's the real glorious thing to consider. And these things are all framed by looking at them through the lens of the fear of Yahweh. And that's what happened at the end of the story. Is that Solomon's, obviously not in real life, right? Rehoboam was a mess. But in Solomon's picture, he did train his son well. And his son turned out to find a good wife who lived that life of helping the poor and oppressed and was contented. And raised his own children in the fear of Lord, in the fear of the Lord, and the cycle continues, right? They were then, those children, Solomon raised his son to be a good parent, who in turn was raising his children to be a good parent. And we see the involvement of both husband and wife to pull that together. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. All right, it was a rather long monologue. I thought we'd have a little more time, but certainly take your questions or comments or your objections. Is it a reasonable case to make? Is it? Okay. What else?
A long time ago, I was influenced by a sermon. Not anymore, though.
Oh, my.
It said, the reason the woman was a virtuous woman was because her husband loved her into it. And I bought that for a while. Until it just didn't make sense anymore.
Yes.
Okay. I have a question about verse 31 of chapter 31. The gates that the woman sits at, is she there? Or do you think she's also there with her husband? Going back to verse, the husband is also an elder in the land. Or is the husband there on her behalf?
I don't remember. Okay. My impression was that she was simply known around the gates, her reputation, and she was identified as being with this husband, and there was the idea of the reputation of both of them of being excellent, godly people. But I don't know the particulars.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's what I recall off the top of my head. There's a lot in this chapter, and I didn't think we'd get to nearly all of it, so I just skipped most of the details of how much firewood can she chop and whatever else it says. Yeah. Dan?
There's a very important, you emphasized earlier, trust and intentions. So there's a really crucial aspect of that for married life, right? Because if you can trust, if both spouses can trust each other's intentions, it makes a tremendous difference on in conflict in the house or how things will go when something bad happens or disappointment happens. So, for example, those who can't trust each other's intentions, there's a lot of conflict because regardless of intentions, there will still be sin, right? There will still be person does A, other person thought he would do not A, or does A when he thought he would do B, and vice versa, and so on. But someone is constantly suspicious or not able to trust intentions. Then she did that because, you may never actually articulate this, but deep down, well, she's trying to undermine what I'm doing, or she doesn't respect me, or on and on and on and on, and so then the conflict and emotion and such rises. But on the other hand, if there's a trust of intention, that intentions are good, okay, she may have done this thing that I don't like or that I'm disappointed in, but I know she meant well. She's not trying to undermine what I'm doing. There may have been a miscommunication or all these kinds of things, or she may have just faltered or something, or he may have, vice versa. But I know the intentions were good. We probably all know how important that is when others don't impugn our intentions, even if we did something that outwardly was wrong. They know we meant well by it. That makes all the difference in the world. So I guess I'm trying to get at the point that's very strong, that the husband can trust in her. It doesn't mean she always does the right thing. When she trusts in her husband, it doesn't mean he always does the right thing. But the intentions are good.
That's right, yeah. Love believes all things, right, as Paul says. Yep. John?
I wanted to make sure I understood you right, maybe.
Good luck.
Said this chapter is used a lot of times as a bludgeoning or kind of a guilt-inducing. So if a woman was dealing with guilt over this, maybe, is maybe the point, I might just sound stupid right now, but maybe I missed it, but is the point that they're a woman who fears God and one who is a helpmeet to their husband that helps him in his vocation, his calling, or whatever.
Yeah, I think that is the point. I think what we're seeing is this woman at the end of a process, not at the beginning. This isn't written on as a perspective of their honeymoon.
Yeah.
Right? It's written as a perspective of many years later. I mean, they have children and they're grown at some age and industry, and he's now old enough to be an elder and respected. So the idea that this is where you start is not behind it, but this is one of the ways you want to end up. Is having for the man to have a calling in life and for the family to be working together to fulfill that calling.
Sure.
When you said earlier this is written for the man or something like that, I thought the first thing that came to mind when you said it was, oh, this is how you pick a wife, is what you're trying to say. But, of course, in practice, this is not how you can pick a wife because, you know, if you get married at age 20, say, or 22, right, you're not going to be able to look and say, oh, yes, she does this, 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 this.
That's right.
Right. So you want to marry a woman who's follows the Lord.
That's right. So. Yeah. And then you'll work out all the particulars as you move along. That's right. Yeah. You want to marry somebody with the potential. You're not going to marry somebody, and neither is she, just for the record. Right? Neither is she. You know, she's not marrying somebody who's at the gates, right? Ready? I mean, that's the flip side of this, which is why he needs to learn to curb his passions and to be a godly man, too, so that he'll be attractive to someone who wants to raise their family in the fear of the Lord. Yes?
Helpful and everything, but I just wanted to point out that she seems to be kind of at a peak in her life.
Right.
She doesn't seem to have small babies and small children, which is the result of years of hard work with her husband. I don't think all wives should be slipping in and saying, why am I not buying the adjacent lot next door? And why am I not doing all these things right now?
That's right. Yeah. This is the result of a maturing relationship, not a beginning one. Yeah. Yes.
And I don't think, from what I'm hearing in this conversation, that a woman can achieve all these things without the growing with her husband, the support from her husband.
Oh, absolutely. That's right.
Which I think a lot of times we think, oh, this is what I have to do. And not realizing that it's a team effort, that you're not going to achieve this without the care of your husband. And you're supporting him, he's supporting you, you're working on this together, you're growing in the fear of the Lord together.
Proverbs has beautiful pictures of marriage all the way through. Beautiful pictures. Beautiful pictures of marriage. I hope the world would envy Christian marriages. Because the alternatives are not beautiful. They're really not. Well, we're running a bit over. Let's close in prayer.